Greetings and transitory microlegations, my tropoponically allegoric listeners, and welcome to this October 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this summarily Lapterian science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. This first piece of science news was just revealed today. All right, so for you it'll be a couple of weeks ago, but what's interesting is that it actually took place several months ago, and for reasons I'll explain, nobody was talking about it, if you could believe that. It turns out some 130 million years ago, two extremely dense balls of matter collided with each other. These two neutron stars, which are the city-sized cores of deceased giant stars, spiraled inward and merged to become a giant fireball. In that collision, they generated a sonorous ripple in space-time known as a gravitational wave. On August 17th of this year, that ripple from 130 million light-years away finally reached Earth. Researchers located at two different gravitational wave observatories in the U.S., Louisiana, and Washington, saw the signal as a gravitational wave. These groups are called LIGO, L-I-G-O. The European collaborator, Virgo, didn't see anything, and they think that that means that the wave originated from one of Virgo's blind spots. Anyway, as the wave moved through the observatory's tiny plot of space-time, it stretched and compressed their detector's kilometer-long arms, and it was the fifth gravitational wave to be detected by humans ever. This wave, however, was different from the previous four. First, it was the first gravitational wave ever observed to come from a neutron stars, as I said earlier. All the other detected gravitational waves have come from black holes colliding with each other. Even cooler, for the first time, LIGO and Virgo got a gang of old-school telescopes like the Hubble telescope and the European Very Large Telescope to help out. Minutes after the gravitational wave signal came in, they alerted their observatory buddies and advised them to point their telescopes in this direction. Collectively, some 70 observatories were able to see the astronomical event by capturing different types of waves, X-ray, ultraviolet, optical, infrared, and radio. Combining their telescopic signals with the gravitational wave signal, they were able to locate the event and identify that it originated from two neutron stars, and then describe the collision in multimedia detail. Now, the most hilarious part of this story is that all the scientists, more than 1,500 of them, were involved in this gravitational wave work, and they all agreed not to tell anyone about it until today. I guess they didn't do a very good job, because rumors have been circulating about this for the last couple of months in the scientific community. But what do you expect for 1,500 people, plus subsidiary staff? Let's continue on an astrophysics theme. You have probably heard about the hunt for dark matter, a mysterious substance thought to permeate the universe, the effects of which we can see through, well, gravitational pull. There are, however, a number of physicists who are beginning to wonder whether dark matter is not just a convenient but fanciful theory. We'll ignore that and just continue with the idea that dark matter exists. So, if dark matter exists, there's a little problem. The problem is that with our model of the universe right now, there should be about twice as much ordinary matter out there, not dark matter, than compared to what we've observed so far. So the question is, where did all this extra regular matter go? Well, ta-da! The missing matter between galaxies has finally been found. This is the first detection of roughly half of the normal matter in our universe, protons, neutrons, electrons, unaccounted for by previous observations of stars and galaxies and other really bright objects in space. Two separate teams found the missing matter, made of particles called baryons, rather than dark matter, and linking galaxies together through filaments of hot, diffuse gas. Because the gas is so tenuous and not quite hot enough for X-ray telescopes to pick up, nobody has been able to see it before. Dr. Hideki Tanimura, who headed one of the projects, published this month in the online journal Archive, said, quote,
There's no sweet spot, no sweet instrument that we've invented yet that can directly observe this gas. It's been purely speculation until now. Unquote. So the two groups had to find another way to definitively show that these threads of gas are really there. Both teams took advantage of a phenomenon called, hold your hats for this one, the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect that occurs when light left over from the Big Bang passes through hot gas. As light travels, some of it scatters off electrons in the gas, leaving a dim patch in the cosmic microwave background, our snapshot of the remnants from the birth of the universe. Now, back in 2015, a map was created that showed the cosmic microwave background throughout the observable universe with the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect being taken into account. Now, because the tendrils of gas between the galaxies are so diffuse, the dim blotches that they cause are far too slight to be seen directly on that map.
Both research teams selected pairs of galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that were expected to be connected by a strand of baryons. They stacked the Planck signals for the areas between the galaxies, making the individually faint strands detectable by creating an en-masse signal. Tanimura's team stacked data on 260,000 pairs of galaxies. He found definitive evidence of gas filaments between the galaxies. Tanimura's group found that they were almost three times denser than the mean for normal matter in the universe. And the other European group stacked 1 million galaxies and found that they were six times denser, which was confirmation that the gas in these areas is dense enough to actually form the filaments. Tanimura says, quote, "We expect some differences because we are looking at filaments at different distances. If this factor is included, our findings are very consistent with de Graaff's group." Of course, finally finding the extra baryons that have been predicted for decades of simulations validates some of our assumptions about the universe. These results go a long way towards showing that many of our ideas of how galaxies form and how structures form over the history of the universe are pretty much correct. Unquote. Okay, let's do a biology paper next. This latest piece of research came out a couple of weeks ago in the journal Nature Communications, and I was more than a little bummed by the results, let me tell you. It turns out that proton transport inhibitor drugs that keep you from getting acid reflux are not good for you. Notice I did not mention any particular brand of drugs. Turns out they're all not good for you. Why? Well, according to Dr. Bernd Schnabel of the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine, stomach acid suppression in mice and humans alters specific gut bacteria in a way that promotes liver injury and progression of three types of chronic liver disease. Given the unhappy state of my stomach a good proportion of the time, I was not exactly thrilled to hear this. I take 4 to 5 Pepcids a week, so that's actually a lot. Schnabel says, quote, "Our stomachs produce gastric acid to kill ingested microbes, and taking medication to suppress gastric acid secretion can change the composition of the gut microbes. Since we found previously that the gut microbiome, the community of bacteria and other microbes living there, can influence liver disease risk, we wondered what effect gastric acid suppression might have on the progression of chronic liver disease. We found that the absence of gastric acid promotes the growth of enterococcus bacteria in the intestines and translocation to the liver, where they exacerbate inflammation and worsen chronic liver disease," unquote. It turns out that anti-acid drugs are among the most commonly prescribed medications in the world and available almost anywhere, even over the counter. They are also relatively inexpensive medications, retailing for about $7 for a recommended 2-week course of generic over-the-counter omeprazole, trade name Prilosec. But the frequency of the use adds up. As one recent study estimates, Americans spend about $11 billion on these drugs every year. That was billion with a B. The University of California team wanted to determine the effect of gastric acid suppression on the progression of chronic liver disease. And so they looked at mouse models that mimic alcoholic liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease,
and non-alcoholic hepatitis. In each case, they blocked gastric acid production either by genetic engineering or with a proton inhibitor, like omeprazole, Prilosec. They also sequenced microbe-specific genes collected from the animal's stool to determine the gut microbiome makeup of each mouse with or without blocked gastric acid production. And amazingly, they found that mice with gastric acid suppression developed alterations in their gut microbiome. Specifically, they had more Enterococcus species of bacteria, which promoted liver inflammation and liver injury, which I said already. The authors noted that these phenomena increased the progression of all three types of liver disease, whether it was alcohol-induced liver disease, non-alcohol-induced liver disease, or hepatitis. To actually confirm that it was the increased Enterococcus that made it worse, the researchers colonized mice with the common gut bacteria Enterococcus faecalis to mimic the overgrowth of intestinal enterococci they had observed following gastric acid suppression. They found increased Enterococcus alone was sufficient to induce mild hepatitis and increase alcohol-induced liver disease in mice. Schnabel finishes with this very long quote. Quote, "Our findings indicate that the recent rise in use of gastric acid-suppressing medications might have contributed to the increased incidence of chronic liver disease. We believe clinicians should consider withholding medications that suppress gastric acid unless there is a strong medical indication. Also remember that even non-proton pump inhibitor-based antacids, Pepto-Bismol, Tums, Tagamet, Zantac, they all still suppress gastric acid to a lesser degree. Any medication that suppresses gastric acid effectively could cause changes in gut bacteria and thus potentially affect the progression of chronic liver disease. We recommend non-pharmacological methods for managing heartburn as an option for some patients, including losing weight, reducing intake of alcohol, caffeine, and fatty and spicy foods," unquote. Oh, joy. Not only do I need to give up my Pepcid, I need to give up my spicy, fatty, caffeinated food as well. Well, this is more dire than global warming, folks. Oh, the humanity. Let's talk about something completely different. Here in the Northeast United States, it's now autumn, and that means leaves turning color and falling to the earth in a beautiful procession of changes. I guess it's appropriate to talk about leaf fall at this time of year. And oddly enough, it was not until relatively recently that plant biologists figured out how the color changes actually occur. The process that I've described where leaves turn color and fall is called leaf senescence. And in it, chlorophyll breaks down, leaving behind yellow and orange pigments, as well as red pigments, synthesized from sugars. In 2006 and 2007, several research groups identified a gene that they believed influenced chlorophyll degradation. The gene is called StayGreen, SGR, which, interestingly enough, was described way back in the mid-1800s by Gregor Mendel in his famous pea plant experiments. However, the researchers were unable to pinpoint SGR's exact function in a larger senescence process. This year, Dr. Hisashi Ito and his team of scientists at the Institute of Low Temperature Science at Hokkaido University unearthed new information regarding pigment degradation, and they published their findings in the journal Plant Cell. Ito says the SGR gene codes for magnesium dechelatase, the last unidentified enzyme in the chlorophyll degradation pathway. Ito says, quote, "We believed it was important to complete the metabolic pathway to understand life. Chlorophyll degradation is important in how it optimizes the photosystem to the light environment. It also helps to maintain cell viability during senescence," unquote. During the first steps of senescence, magnesium dechelatase pulls a magnesium ion from a chlorophyll molecule, and thus it degrades the chlorophyll to a molecule called pheophyton, an important molecule in the electron transport chain. Ito observed this process by temporarily inducing SGR expression in excised green Thale crest leaves for 30 hours. Compared to wild-type leaves, they saw a reduction in chlorophyll levels and an increase in pheophyton and noticeable color changes in the test group. The team complemented this finding by also incubating chlorophyll in vitro with the enzyme, which resulted in a more efficient conversion of chlorophyll to pheophyton. To further confirm the SGR's function, the group introduced the gene into a cyanobacterium called Senecococcus elongatus, which has no endogenous dechelation activity in it, nor does its genome contain any genes with significant homology to SGR. And to their surprise, the Senecococcus successfully expressed the SGR, which led to low levels of chlorophyll content and much higher levels of pheophyton and other converted molecules. With that last piece of the puzzle in place, Ito and his colleagues now plan to focus on other mechanisms at play during senescence. All right, next story. More science fraud! Wow, you can't trust those scientists at all, can you? Here's a story I came across. Last month, a protein engineer who studies biofuels at Virginia Tech was arrested on charges of defrauding the U.S. government. Yi-Heng Percival Zhang, along with his postdoc Chun Yu and his former student Ziguang Zhu, are accused of misusing grant funds topping over $1 million. Let me say, any of you listeners in the U.S. government granting agencies, I would never defraud you guys. Just watch. You give me $1 million for my research, and you will see. You will get back real research. Anybody? Anybody at all? Come on. Just an offer. $500,000. I'll take $250,000. Why is it that the rotten ones always get the grant money? Well, according to his lawyer, Dr. Zhang insists he's innocent. Zhang's lawyer, Scott Austin, says, quote, Dr. Zhang maintains his innocence and intends to vigorously fight these charges, unquote. According to the Federal Bureau of Investigation's complaint published in the Washington Post, Zhang took money from the National Science Foundation and Department of Energy for work that had already been done and finished, and he didn't distribute the funds appropriately to the university. Zhu and Yu allegedly submitted false claims to the government and, quote, conspired to engage in a scheme to defraud the NSF, unquote, according to the complaint. Zhu and Yu, by the way, now work for the Tianjin Institute of Industrial Biotechnology in China, where Zhang is also affiliated. Oh yeah, good luck getting those two back off of communist Chinese soil for extradition. Like that's ever going to happen. Anyway, according to the Roanoke Times, Zhang is in additional legal trouble. A former employee of Zhang's startup company, Cell Free Bioinnovations, is suing him for taking confidential information to another firm. Good luck, Dr. Zhang. You're going to need it. Perhaps you should have fled to China with your compatriots. Oh. Last story of the evening. A caterpillar that can mimic a bird's warning. North American walnut sphinx moth caterpillars look like easy meals for birds, but they have a trick up their sleeves. They can produce whistles that sound like bird alarm calls, and they can scare potential predators away. When they first heard this, scientists suspected birds were simply startled by the loud noise, but a new study presented at the International Symposium on Acoustic Communication by Animals in Omaha last July, suggests a more sophisticated mechanism. The caterpillar's whistle appears to mimic a bird call, sending avian predators scrambling for cover. Main author Dr. Jessica Lindsay of the University of Washington says, quote, this is the first instance of deceptive alarm calling between an insect and a bird, and it's a novel defense form for an insect. It is pretty wild, unquote. When pecked by a bird, the caterpillars whistle by compressing their bodies like an accordion and forcing air out through specialized holes on their sides. The whistles are pretty loud, considering they're made by a 2-inch-long insect. They've been measured at over 80 decibels
from 5 centimeters away from the caterpillar. That's about the same level of noise as a garbage disposal makes. Okay, listen to this. This is a recording of these little buggers. In a laboratory experiment, birds responded to caterpillar whistles by jumping away and abandoning their predation attempts. This behavior was initially attributed to a general startle response, as I said earlier, but to Lindsay, those whistles looked acoustically similar to alarm calls made by birds called seat calls. Many bird species produce and recognize seat calls, which are short, high-pitched tweets made when a flying predator is spotted. Upon hearing a seat call, birds will scatter and drop to low bushes for cover or just freeze in place. Lindsay played recordings of caterpillar whistles, black-capped chickadee seat calls, and house finch songs as a control to flocks of wild birds at backyard feeders. The bird feeders Lindsay targeted were most often visited by black-capped and mountain chickadees and red-breasted nuthatches, but numerous other avian species stopped by during the study. Lindsay played her experimental sounds in random order, recording video and audio for 2 minutes before the playback, during the 1 minute playback stimulus, and then for 5 minutes after the playback ended. The birds ignored the finch song, but responded to the caterpillar whistles and the seat calls in the same way, diving for cover, freezing, and making their own alarm calls. The behavior was the same regardless of the species. Lindsay finished with, quote, "For both the genuine alarm call and the caterpillar whistle, birds responded by fleeing the bird feeder and taking a long time to return or freezing in place. If nuthatches were present, we would see them flicking their wings, which is a sign of distress. We found that initial responses to alarm calls can depend on a simple acoustic feature, like peak frequency. So it seems plausible that a caterpillar sound could mimic a key feature of seat calls," unquote. Lindsay is currently analyzing the audio recordings from the playback experiments to uncover any pattern in the calls birds made in response to the different stimuli, as well as the acoustic structure of those calls. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Maybe cut down on proton pump inhibitors until we know more. Don't trust caterpillars. They're all liars. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.